Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me is the returning co-host from our very first episode of Sophomore Lit, my little brother, Dan McCoy.
And let's qualify this by saying that little means 40 years old.
You'll always be that little kid who got chased into the lake by geese to me. But we're not here to pick on Dan. We are here to talk about I was about to say bad movies, but that's not it. We're here to talk about books we read back in high school or middle school. And in this case, we are doing what I know is one of Dan's favorite books in the world, or at least it used to be, The Westing Game by Ellen Raskin.
Yeah, I mean, this is a book that I certainly loved at the time, but I had actually forgotten about. I have been going through this period of rereading books that were important to me when I was a kid, like The Princess Bride and Harpo Speaks and All Creatures Great and Small, all these things that I read when I was younger and really enjoyed, and I've been revisiting them because I'm mired in nostalgia rather than forging a bold path into the future. And The Westing Game I had kind of forgotten about, but it would have been one that I would have added to the list to reread, definitely, because of how much I liked it at the time.
Well, all I remember is that I would come back from college and you would have a copy of The Westing Game lying around in your room or on one of the tables. And it would, every time I would come back, it would be a little bit more dog-eared and a little bit more torn up. So you must have read it, dozens of times from around, 1986 to around 1992.
Fortunately for this reread, I had forgotten everything except for the major twist of the book. So,
oh yeah,
I was okay. It still surprised me.
Oh, by the way, you speak of major twists. I just want to make it clear to listeners out there, because this is a crazy, convoluted mystery book for kids with lots and lots of misdirects and red herrings and surprises, and I'm just not going to worry about it. So if you don't want to be spoiled for 1978's The Westing Game, I suggest you stop listening to the podcast right now and go get yourself a copy. They're available used in any used bookstore in America, and read it. It'll probably take you an afternoon to read, and then come back and listen to this podcast.
This was a hugely widely read book, because based on an informal poll of my friends during the period that I was rereading The Westing Game, I was chatting with some friends over text and then some friends I saw in person, work friends, and I asked them if they had read The Westing Game when they were younger, and all of them had, and all of them remembered it vividly.
Well, if you do any secondary reading of this, if you do like a cursory Google search, you will find dozens and dozens of personal essays out there, various qualities of personal essays. Some are very good, but all of them acknowledge this as a formative text in becoming a reader, because it's a book that introduces you as a young reader to a lot of concepts, like the idea of a what's called a free indirect narrator. The free indirect style is a narrator who takes on the thoughts of characters. So you have a chatty narrative voice that is close to the minds of the characters, and that can also lead you astray in this book. It's a book that leads you to distrust everyone and to suspect everyone. It's a book that sets up some mysteries that are fairly easy to figure out. And if you're a kid, you think, oh, I'm pretty clever. I'm cleverer in the character than the characters in this book because I already am getting this. And then you, as you go down into the book further, you realize that those are just the surface mysteries. It encourages you to also go back and reread the book, I think. After you've read it through one time, you want to go back and find out whether or not Raskin has played fair with you and whether or not Raskin has given you all the clues.
I think I liked it as a child as a mystery because it you can put all the clues together yourself. They all exist within the book. It's not a type of mystery where I feel like you aren't truly given enough information to make the to pinpoint what's going on yourself. I mean, and part of that is because it's less a mystery book really than it is a puzzle book, because all of its mysteries are kind of based on wordplay and who got kicked in the shins most recently.
Normally in this podcast, I don't go that much extra textually, but I am going to in this case because Ellen Raskin is about as close as I come in my life to having a true hero, someone who I have looked up to for as long as I have known of her existence. And as the years go on, I think of her as a more remarkable person. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that her first book for kids that she wrote as well as illustrated, because she came from a background of graphic design and illustration, was the picture book Nothing Ever Happens on My Block, which is sadly out of print, but which is the first book I have any recollection of reading. And in many ways, that's sort of like the Westin game for the four-year-old set, in that it is a book that in which all the action in the book takes place in the background and small details of the illustration that change from page to page. And as a kid, you want to spy all these little crazy things that are happening in the story. It's this wonderful sense you have that the world is full of puzzles, that by being observant, you can know more about the world than the people who ostensibly are the actors in that world. She wrote a lot of picture books for children, and they are all crazy and fresh and funky, and they show off her amazing skill as an illustrator. If you know the original cover to A Wrinkle in Time, the one from the 1960s that had the silhouettes of the main characters on a kind of an op art set of swirls, that was Ellen Raskin who did that. She worked for New Directions for many years, and she did probably the best edition of A Child's Christmas in Wales by Dylan Thomas, which is still in print and has been in print continuously, I think, since the late 1950s. She's just a fantastic illustrator as well as an author. And if you go back and read the story of the making of this book, she designed the original cover. She designed the typeset and the title heads for this book. And she actually had several hundred copies of the first edition of this book destroyed because the margins were off by a quarter of an inch. So anyway, Ellen Raskin, a fantastic woman, who sadly died rather young, I believe in her early 50s, shortly after writing The Westin Game. She died of some sort of a degenerative muscle disease. It's not clear from her obituaries or from the essays that I've read what that was. It seems as though her family was keeping it private, and I will keep it private too, except to note that this book is also a book that has people who have, it has one character who suffers from a neurological disease. It has people who suffer from various forms of infirmity, as in getting kicked in the shins. And it has, for 1978, a crazily progressive cast of characters.
Yeah. No, go. I mean, I just wanted to agree. Like, that was one thing that stuck out to me reading the book, the fact that they had a differently abled person, they had a a black woman judge, a Chinese couple, and like the ethnicities were part of their characters, but they were not the whole of their characters, and they were treated with great like respect, each and every last one of them. And I found that very striking for a children's book of the period.
I mean, the other thing that is funny to me, I was thinking about this with you, that the character of Sam Westing, Uncle Sam, is this eccentric industrialist. Part of what was the impetus for writing this was shortly before she started writing this, Howard Hughes had died, and there was something of a furor in this country about whether his will was authentic and who was going to inherit his fortune. And that was something that was on her mind. She wrote this character originally as a crooked robber baron, strike breaker. But as she rewrote and rewrote this book, he becomes this marvelous magician that's pulling all the strings from behind the scenes. And it occurred to me he's in some ways he's sort of not that far from Scrooge McDuck.
Right. I thought that was where you were going with it. Like maybe that was my fondness for both of them, is they have this strange, amoral on the surface, you know, kind of soft inside industrialist character. Yeah, it was very whimsical. I also thought that when I was reading this, that the book in many ways reminds me of something like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, with the same sort of crazed, you know, like it's not clear how nice Sam Westing means to be with his game and how cruel he means to be with it by the end. And
right.
That's kind of an interesting angle on him, even though you're meant to look at him very affectionately by the end of the book.
We could talk a little bit about that with the plot, because that is an interesting point. You could say, after you've read the book through, that the game started as a very cruel attempt to gain revenge upon one of the players. But it ended up by becoming this transformative experience for all who were involved. And they all kind of went on to have fantastic and interesting lives, but more fantastic and more interesting lives because they're intersections with other people's lives, the other characters' lives. The other thing about this book was it was written originally in, she started it in 1976, when the country was in the grips of bicentennial furor. Now, Dan, you were not born in 76, but I remember 76, and I remember the way that the whole country was just nuts that whole summer long, I think, for the bicentennial. And everywhere you went, there were fire hydrants painted like American flags. And there was Schoolhouse Rock was on the TV teaching us all about the formation of the country. There was a lot of pride in American culture, kind of unquestioning pride. You know, it was very ostentatious and boastful. And the other thing that occurred to me as I was reading this through is West becomes a very important idea through this book. We have Sam Westing. We have Sunset Towers, which faces east. Westing is actually a corruption of another name. But I was wondering if this is in some way a commentary on Manifest Destiny that somehow got lost, because I think that Raskin started this book as much more of a pointed satire about labor relations, and it ended up becoming this celebration of America.
So wait, what what knowledge do you have of the earlier drafts of the book?
There's a very interesting thing you can do. If you go to the American Library Association's page, there is a collection of all the acceptance speeches for the Newbery winners, and there is a recording L.N. Raskin made of her acceptance speech which is quite wonderful to listen to all the way through. And she describes her process in writing this book. I believe from the quality of the recording, she must have recorded this in a studio sometime after the fact or before the fact. It's not the recording of her at the actual ceremony, but it is the speech she gave at the ceremony. And she talks at length about her initial attempts to write this book. This book takes place in Wisconsin. It takes place in Milwaukee, but she's actually thinking of where she grew up, which was Sheboygan, which was a city that was almost entirely founded on the wealth of the Kohler factory there, the Kohler factory that makes toilets. If you ever see Kohler on a toilet, that's the one that's made in Sheboygan. And the guy who, the Mr. Kohler, who ran that factory, was a notorious anti-unionist. And she was originally going to base Sam Westing on him, but she couldn't do it, I guess, after rewriting and rewriting the book. Because the other thing that is funny about this is she admits she had no idea what she was doing when she wrote this book. She did not plan the plot ahead.
Yeah.
She wrote some of the stuff, and then she had to come up with justification for it.
Yes. I mean, I find that astounding with this kind of... I mean, like, the justification after the fact, I suppose I can see where that makes things a lot easier, but even to just go back and seed things that you need to be seeded through the whole thing, I don't know. I'm reminded of, apparently, the Coen brothers work this way, where they write themselves into a corner without any particular idea of what's going to happen next and just continue from that point.
You also have to remember that you go through other drafts after that. And she went through several drafts of this book. This book centers on the assumed murder of Sam Westing. And apparently in her first draft, she also thought that Sam was going to be dead, that there was going to be a guest who killed him, which spoiler now, Westing is not dead. Although I think that if you read this as a grown up, you might not be as surprised by that as if you read it as a child. So I don't want to give a huge plot summary to this book, because there's a lot of action in this book, and a plot summary would be about as long as the book itself.
Yeah.
But briefly, the idea is that a new luxury apartment building is put up on the shores of Lake Michigan, facing the estate of industrialist Sam Westing, who is missing, presumed dead. The tenants of this building have been coaxed to rent their apartments in this building under false pretenses by a gentleman who tries to tell them that there's only one apartment left in each case, when in fact they were handpicked for this game that's about to take place. Shortly after they all move in, one of the young tenants of the building, named Turtle Wexler, a young girl with a single pigtail, who dresses as a witch, discovers Sam Westing's body, or what she thinks is Sam Westing's body, in the mansion. And the next day, 16 of the tenants are assembled to discuss the will that Sam Westing has left. And the will itself is a quite remarkable bit of flim-flammery and pastiche of the kind of thought of the Gilded Age. And let's just listen to a little bit of it here.
I, Samuel W. Westing, resident of Westing County in the fair state of Wisconsin in the great and glorious United States of America, being of sound mind and memory, do hereby declare this to be my last will and testament. First, I returned to live among my friends and my enemies. I came home to seek my heir, aware that in doing so I faced death. And so I did. Today I have gathered together my nearest and dearest, my 16 nieces and nephews. Sit down, Grace Windsor Wexler, to view the body of your Uncle Sam for the last time. Tomorrow its ashes will be scattered to the four winds. Second, I, Samuel W. Westing, hereby swear that I did not die of natural causes. My life was taken from me by one of you. The police are helpless. The culprit is far too cunning to be apprehended for this dastardly deed. I alone know the name. Now it is up to you. Cast out the sinner, let the guilty rise and confess. Third, who among you is worthy to be the Westing heir? Help me. My soul shall roam restlessly until that one is found. The estate is at the crossroads. The heir who wins the windfall will be the one who finds the... Fourth, hail to thee, O land of opportunity. You have made me, the son of poor immigrants, rich, powerful, and respected. So take stock in America, my heirs, and sing in praise of this generous land. You, too, may strike it rich who dares to play the Westing game.
This gives a good feel for the way that Raskin is going to play the game. As you say, it's a game. This book is filled with wordplay. It's filled with irony. It's filled with characters that are at once larger than life, but as you get to know them, they're actually motivated by interesting personal foibles. You're, as a young reader, encouraged to question everything. Eventually, what happens is the 16 heirs, as they're called, that apparently have no real connection to Sam Westing, are given a set of clues, words written down on scraps of paper. Each of them is given a certain amount of clues, and they're told that it's what they don't have that is important. As the book goes on, we meet all these characters. Do you want to mention some of the characters, or shall I just go down
the list? You can go down the list. There's so many of them.
There's a Chinese-American couple, the Hu's. Madam Hu doesn't speak English. It turns out that through the course of the book that she has been stealing from the other characters to try to finance a trip home to China, but you don't know who's stealing. That's one of the many side mysteries of the book. The father, Mr. Hu, is running a restaurant on the top of the apartments that's not doing very well. We have the Wexlers. The father is a podiatrist. The mother fancies herself an interior decorator. We've mentioned Turtle, who is the smart, spunky kid that you kind of know is going to emerge as the hero of the book. And her older sister, Angela, who is very beautiful, and that seems to be her defining characteristic, but who does not want to simply be a pretty girl who ends up marrying her fiancé, Dr. Denton Dare. And she becomes a sort of a mad bomber, setting off fireworks around the place, eventually becoming injured herself by one of these fireworks when Turtle almost opens the package. There's Judge Ford. You mentioned the African-American judge who loses interest in the game but becomes very interested in tracking down what exactly everyone's connection is to Sam Westing. And she's paired with Sandy, who is the elderly doorman of the estates, who is able to gather all kinds of information on all the tenants. And that fills up our knowledge of how they're connected. But of course, Sandy has his own dark secret, and it turns out that he is partially responsible for leading characters astray. I mean, there's so many other characters. There are 16 characters in all. I'm not going to go through them all, but you can also mention just briefly. There's one of the characters, Sidel Pulaski. I love this. She's the one who's paired with Angela, and she turns out to be there because she was the wrong Pulaski was given an invitation. And that's a wonderful grace note, I think, in a book that is so full of this crazily constructed plot where everyone seems to be manipulated the other central metaphor of the book is chess. Sam Westing was a great chess player. There's a chessboard that's set out where in the reading room where all the heirs meet to hear the will, and it seems to be playing itself against one of the characters. Every time he goes by, he makes another move, and someone is making a move behind the scenes. It seems like there's a puppet master behind all this, but the puppet master isn't infallible.
This is kind of outside of what we're talking about right now, but can I mention one thing that was sort of my favorite thing that rereading as an adult, you see some of the seams in things that maybe didn't occur to you as a child. And I don't think this is like a huge problem with the book, because I don't think the book is meant to be taken entirely seriously or entirely literally. But it's funny to me that Sam Westing tricks all these people who are associated with him into the same building, and then they seem to only spend time with other people in the building. Like, it is like a completely hermetically sealed life. Like, I guess the doctor character does not live within the building, but everyone else, but he's connected to someone within the building, and they all just, regardless of social class or job, seem to be mixing with each other all the time. I mean, part of that is because they become these competitors, so that makes sense. But even before that, it seems like this is just a closed universe where nothing exists outside this high rise.
Right. Well, part of that is, part of that, of course, is Raskin playing with the form of the closed door mystery. As I recall, also in the 1970s, Agatha Christie was extremely popular then. I mean, Agatha Christie wrote her great novels in the 30s and 40s, but by the 70s, there had been the Sidney Lumet Murder on the Orient Express. And I think that kicked off a rebirth of interest in that. Mm. I think the 70s were also a period of great nostalgia for the 30s and 40s. I think it was the 30-year cycle or whatever. And so Christie was in everyone's mind. This is kind of, in some ways, it plays with all those silly conventions. And ultimately, a lot of that theme and that mood and those plot elements melt away toward the growing story of these people getting to know each other and getting to understand each other more. One of the characters that I didn't mention, who's very important to mention, is Crow, as she's called. She is the maid at the apartment buildings and is a highly religious woman who dresses in black lace. It turns out that Crow is the ex-wife of Sam Westing. And as the story goes on, she's the one who's being implicated by the clues. The clues are these random words. I think anyone who reads this book through, who has the slightest knowledge of Americana, will quickly realize that the clues are words from America the Beautiful. That's what I was saying when I think that as a kid, if you read this through, you're like, oh, I get what's going on here. I understand what's going on here. That these are all these, and none of the characters get it, you know, because there are words in the clues that just stick out, like amber, purple waves.
Fruited.
Right, fruited, exactly. But it isn't until you get all the clues put out together that you realize that there have been elisions, and those elisions, if you find the words that are missing, spell out Crow's name. It turns out that Westing does blame Crow for the death of his daughter many years ago, because she was going to force her daughter into an unsatisfactory marriage, and the daughter committed suicide, which is a kind of a dark thing to have in a kid's book. There are points in this book where things get kind of nasty. And it's surprising, you know, it's a little surprising that the character we mentioned who has a neurological disease, Chris, that's dealt with, I think, with a lot of sensitivity, but it's really kind of brutal in the description of the symptoms for a book at this time. I think today we expect our children's books, our middle readers, to have a little bit more realism when dealing with these issues. But this was still new ground, I think, when Raskin was writing this book.
Well, I think with the exception perhaps of the fact that it has a child protagonist and the fact that it relies on sort of simple puzzles, beyond that, it does not read like it was a book written for children at all, I don't think.
Yeah, it's written in a kind of a elliptical style, I would say. A lot of things are left out from sentence to sentence, and sometimes large plot points are dropped kind of quietly at the end of paragraphs, so that if you're reading along, you suddenly say, wait, what happened? And you go back and you reread that paragraph, and you have to kind of understand that, especially with like things like the bombs going off. I don't know. There are lots of things where I felt like a children's book would spell out the action more moment to moment than this book does. Mm-hmm. This book looks around at the object in the corners of the room and describes those as a way of getting to the action. It plays with the fact that there are so many characters and they are a little bit difficult to figure out at first. I think it's not until Judge Ford starts making her account of each character in turn that you can actually clearly figure out who's who.
Yeah, with the bombing scene in particular, too, I agree with that. It's kind of, you kind of can guess by the fact that Angela has pushed Turtle out of the way or pulled the present to her when she's opening the present that turns out to be a bomb. You can kind of guess ahead of time that means that she knew that there was a bomb in there, but it's dealt with kind of just quietly at like the most overtly it comes is at the end of the scene next when they're in the hospital and Turtle's like, that was a stupid thing for you to do. And her partner, Pulaski, sort of surmises, oh, okay, she's the bomber. But it happens in a sort of an offhanded way, like you say, this sort of large subplot in the book. And the whole purpose of the subplot of the book is to give Angela's character more depth by way of showing the sort of hidden rage she has inside of her she does not want to have her current life where she's just looked on as pretty and has to marry the doctor.
There are also times where the narrator will half reveal something and then you're left to understand what the import is of that revelation much later. When Judge Ford wants to engage a private investigator to look into the lives of the tenants at the Sunset Towers, she calls someone up over the phone, and then we're told she can't believe that how she recognizes the name. Much later, we learn that she's talking to Otis Amber, who is a delivery boy. He's 62 years old, but he's a delivery boy who turns out to be a private investigator who was hired by Sam Westing. So he's working for both Sam Westing and Judge Ford. You might forget that because it isn't until much later in the book that we are finally told who Otis Amber is. In fact, Otis Amber is initially a suspect for being Sam Westing himself. He seems to be a guy who's hiding a secret. And so in a way, he's a red herring to throw you off the idea of Sam Westing being alive and a character. It does turn out, however, that Sam Westing is alive and is a character. he's Sandy, the doorman. He's also who were the other characters he was? He was
Barney Northrup, is that
right? Barney Northrup, the guy who initially drew everyone to Sunset Towers, and well, he had one other character he was.
Well, he's the character that he turns into at the end, who's East. East is the one remaining calendar direction, map direction that was remaining.
Right, Julian Eastman. Who is the current head of Westing Paper Products. Yeah, as you point out, a East-West joke there. So, and it also turns out that was something that was hinted at in the will, when it says the winner will be the one who finds the, and there's an ellipsis, and the next word is fourth, but we've been set up as a misdirect as the will is being read. We're giving first, second, third, fourth as headers to clauses in the will. It's pretty clever. You go back, you try to make sense of it. You feel like, okay, that's fair.
The thing I wanted to make clear about Sandy is, or observe about Sandy is what you were talking about before with the narrator that drifts from character to character, and how that's sort of used as a misdirect because you kind of assume that it's going to be like we're going to see everything within the character's head rather than just get a sense of what's going on. And you see Sandy like looking through the reports that the private investigator has supplied Judge Ford and laughing at them and reacting to them. But you sort of think, okay, well, this is a man finding out the connection of everybody to Sam Westing rather than perhaps Sam Westing sort of being delighted in what has been found out, you know?
Right. Now, the book has I think, a marvelous ending. Everyone is assembled for their final accusation, sort of like at the end of a game of Clue when you have to make your accusations. And they get it wrong. And some of the characters suspect each other. The two teenage boys suspect Otis Amber, but they can't bring themselves to accuse him because of how they've grown to know him. And Crow takes it upon herself to confess to being the one named in the will. She doesn't say that she's the one who killed Sam Westing. She just says, I'm the one the will's speaking of. She's kind of grown through the book too, in that she's willing to own up to her sense of guilt over what happened to her daughter. The will stipulates that they haven't, no one has actually solved the puzzle. What's funny is the lawyer keeps going out of the room and coming back with another writer to the will. It appears as though Sam Westing has written out a response in case of anything. But in fact, Sam Westing is there and he's able to respond and give new directions as the game goes on. It seems as though no one has won, but Westing gives each of them shares in Sunset Towers. And then the Westinghouse explodes and burns to the ground in another kind of wonderful moment in the book, which is the cover, the original Alan Raskin version of the cover. What happens is Turtle, Clever Turtle, did we ever have any doubt, figures out what's going on, confronts Mr. Eastman, and agrees to keep his secret. And then we have this extended epilogue of all the characters, which is, I'm a 50-year-old man, and I read a lot of Dostoevsky for this podcast. I have to admit, I found myself tearing up so much at the end of this book. You know, maybe nostalgia for it, but it also, for a book that's about, in some ways, American competition. This is a book that ends up with a different view of America, the melting pot America, which, you know, may be as much of a myth when it comes down to it as our myth of competition making the world better. But damned if it didn't make me cry.
No, it did me as well. I mean, I was also reading it on an airplane, which jacks up your emotions. But no, it made me cry as well. And I think it's funny, too, that it's not just an epilogue. It's a double epilogue. We get what happens a little further along down the line to all of the characters. And then we get a many years down the line epilogue of what happens to all of the characters as Turtles relating it to the dying Sam Westing under his new name. And she's also sort of an unreliable narrator. She makes up a nicer ending for some of the people than who have passed on. But yeah, it's funny. Like it could be a sort of a, I don't know, film version of Return of the King, too many endings situation, but I found it very touching, and I thought it was putting just enough weight on all these characters that you're going to quite care about over the course of a silly puzzle mystery.
It's a mitigated ending. There are, you know, Chris, the boy in the wheelchair, is the recipient of a new therapy that allows him to speak clearly, but he never leaves his wheelchair, which I think was a smart move by Raskin, because she doesn't want to give the mega happy ending to this mm-hmm. book. She's going to, like, everyone's. And then at the end, as you say, at the very end of his life, Westing is asking about characters, and Turtle doesn't have the heart to tell him who has died and who is no longer doing what Westing thought that they were doing. And so she tells him beautiful lies as he passes off this mortal coil. And it's a kind of a somber moment, again, in a kid's book, to realize that there isn't ever really a completely happy ending to a story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's well put.
So before we cry more, I did mention a lot of these essays online. There is one that I really want to recommend everybody go out and read. It came out earlier this year by Nicholas Dames. It's on the Public Books website, and it's called We All Must Play the Westing Game. It was published on July 4th of this year, which is appropriate. And he makes an interesting point in this, which is, among other things, he points out that this book, the opening lines of this book, are echoed in Louis Sachar's Holes, which I think is fascinating to me, simply because I am preparing to do a podcast on Holes tomorrow night. And I'll come back to this quote maybe when I discuss that tomorrow night. But everybody, read this essay. It's a beautiful essay. And do you have any last thoughts you want to go on this book before we close up?
No, other than that it holds up tremendously as an adult rereader, and I think it would hold up without nostalgia for an adult reader who missed it the first time around. I think that we've been pretty effusive about the book. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Thanks to my co-host, Dan McCoy. Dan has a podcast, you may have heard of it, called The Flophouse. The reading this time was by Nathan Alderman. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. Write to me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Speaking of writing to me, I had a request to know what the books were coming up. I don't know the exact order, but you can expect in the next few weeks to hear podcasts on Holes, A Prayer for Owen Meany, Enemy of the People, War of the Worlds, and Call the Wild. That's a lot of reading, but try to keep up, because everything will be on the final.